too late.
Dear Shooter, it's summertime, and in the shooting world, all the news is political. Who wants to talk about that? Fortunately, we got a surprise visit from retired Master Sergeant James Gilliland. Let's see what he's been up to lately. But they did state that when these guns are put together with different pieces or whatever, it's like an organ transplant.
Yeah, I got an F in shooting once.
It's a perishable skill.
Quitting?
Yes. My favorite death threat I ever got, the guy left his email address on.
He's just going to make it rain in Spanish, that's all.
Here's 20 cents. Wow, you just made that
clip on. It's not a strap on.
2 weeks for all that? That isn't training, that's camp.
You couldn't read a brochure on all that shit in that time.
Prepare to enter the space where nothing is safe, nothing is sacred, and offensive conversation is encouraged. Welcome to the Deer Shooter Podcast and your hosts, Jason Wilson, Brandy, and Jason Croteau.
I guess that means it's Thursday, and we did. We got a surprise visit from Jim Gilliland, good friend of the program, and we had no idea he was coming. So what have you been up to, and what the hell brings you out here?
So actually been up to a lot of nothing. lately, the last couple of months, actually the last couple of years, you know, the post-COVID era in this industry has been really awkward for a lot of people.
So you're getting good at the nothing.
Oh, I'm really good at nothing. So
I don't know. Every time I see he's building some new contraption, he's got some new car in the shop.
Yeah. So, well, that's actually one of the big things. You know, I've had the first project I was working on was a 1950 model Ford truck, and it was my truck in high school. I've had it for 35 years now. Finally did a complete frame off restoration retro mod. So I finished it up, and then I started on a 70 model short wheelbase four wheel drive truck. So, but yeah, that's all I've been doing. A whole lot of nothing.
So how many do you have stacked in your yard right now?
Enough.
Enough. That's more than five, y'all.
Is that your words or Missy's words?
Too many is her words.
Oh.
So, no, look, Melissa is so gracious about this. And she has raised her eyebrows a few times when I brought something home. But I've brought some home and sold some off and whatever. I just had a 73 Jeep Commando, and I had it for about 18 months, 2 years. I was planning on doing it next, but a guy came by, saw it, and wanted a whole lot more than I wanted to work on it. So I don't have it anymore.
That'll happen. So did you work on it at all, or you just see it?
No,
in
I just
your
drove
weeds?
It. Yeah. No, I did a little bit of maintenance work to it, make sure that the went through the brake system, went through the fuel system, I had to rebuilt the carburetor, and it ran great. I mean, it ran really, really well. The body was really straight on it, didn't have any major flaws in it. There's no rust through spots in anything else. It's going to make the guy an easy frame off restoration.
Now, did you just kind of fall into vehicle restoration, or is it something you've been doing forever?
No, as far as body work and things like that, I've never really been into any of that. I wasn't interested in it or whatnot. Because like I said, I've had that Ford truck for 34 years. I got it when I was 13. I mowed grass and paid for it when I was 13 and brought it home, and it was a frame and a cab, and I put it together. You know, I really didn't do any body work to it or whatever, but with some help with my dad or whatever, I got it running, put the body all together, and bolted it up, and that's what I drove when I turned 16. So, but my neighbor is an old school body guy. He's in mid-80s now, and he saw that I had that truck, wanted to know what I want to do with it, and I told him that I wanted to restore it, and I've been, learning everything I can for him. And he started when he was 15. He's 85 now, so he's forgotten more than I will ever learn.
So you had a good mentor, at least.
Yeah.
Good.
Very good. Yep. So, yeah. But it's been a lot of fun. It's, one of the things I've noticed, in general or whatever, and it's not just military guys, whatever, but dudes that have worked for a long time in one thing and got out of it, retired or whatever, like I did. It's been 9 years now since I retired from the military. I stayed really busy shortly after that, but I hit a static period where I was laying on the couch not doing anything and realized that I really, really needed to get up and start doing something.
Well, let's put some of that in perspective, though. You joined the Army and somehow wrangled yourself into a Ranger position, and they let you do what? Every job that they have available?
Pretty much.
You were there for 17, 18 years?
No, I was in regiment. I was in a Ranger regiment for about 6.5 years.
Okay.
So, yep. In my first 6.5 years in the Army, and I came in initially. I was a mortar kid because I scored too high on my GT score on the mathematics part. So, and I was an unassigned infantry kid, unassigned airborne, unassigned infantry when I came in. Thought I had a Ranger 11 Bravo Ranger contracts. What I thought I had, but in reality, that's not so much. So when I was in basic, they started calling out, all the guys that I was hanging out with, or friends of mine or whatever else, and waiting for my name to be called, and never got called. And I kind of looking around, and most, like 99% of the dudes that I was hanging out with were gone. There were like three, maybe four guys that I thought, was okay with. So, all the guys left, whatever. I'm looking around and be like, all right, what the fuck? Like, why am I still here? And, everybody's like, oh, yeah, we got rid of those 11 Bravos. We're all 11 Charlies in here now. And I'm like, what the fuck's 11 Charlie? And you're like, oh, that's a mortar guy. I'm like, what's a mortar? So.
Come here, kid. Let me show you.
Yeah. So for the next, all my AIT, I did mortar stuff. And then right before I left, whatever, they gave us all orders of where we were supposed to go next. I had an airborne contract, so I was going to airborne school, but they gave me orders to go to the 82nd. I'm like, no, I'm going to Ranger Battalion. They're like, oh, no, here's your orders to the 82nd, bud. Have a good one. And so I spent the next – I had a 0 week when I went to airborne school, and I had the 3 weeks I was in airborne school, and I was calling Ranger Regiment every day, whatever number I could find in the phone book, to try to get somebody to help. How do I do this? How do I go over there? Because I got orders to 82nd. And they're like, sound like you're going to Fort Bragg, bud. If they would talk to me, most of the time I got to, hey, this is Private Gilliland. I'm in airborne school right now. I'd like to click. And I'd call back, click. And I'd be like, and then they just quit answering the phone for me or whatever. Anyway, so at the end of airborne school, me and another guy, redheaded kid that was a good friend with, named Thad Jones. He was 11 Charlie. Went through, the same basic everything I did or whatever. And we're standing on the corner, on the curb or whatever, waiting for our little Greyhound bus to show up to take us to Fort Bragg, because here I am with orders to the 82nd that I absolutely loathed. I was so distraught at the moment. And the biggest freaking dude I've ever seen in my whole life comes walking out in a perfect uniform with a black beret, with spit shine boots on, jungle boots, whatever. And, he stands up there and he's like, give me all my Rangers over here. And so all these dudes and guys that I knew that were in my basic were going over there. And I'm like, these dudes are never going to make this shit. It's nothing against them, whatever. It's just in my mind. Of course, here I am, 16 weeks into the Army or 18, whatever into the Army. I'm like, yeah, that dude's not going to make it. Like I knew something or whatever. And so they're all standing over there, and a bus is pull up to take us to Fort Bragg, and I'm kind of look over at the little formation that was over there, and I look back at Thad that was standing next to me, and I look back over to the formation. I'm like, and I reach down and pick my bags up, and he's like, dude, what are you doing? He's like, you're getting in a lot of trouble. And I'm like, maybe. And I just walked over to the formation where the Ranger kids were, right? And then, he gets on the bus, and he's, looking out the window, and he's like,
Like a cat in the
hell?
Back window.
Yeah, like, what the hell, dude? And so the buses pull off, and this guy's like, all right, and they ran us down the street to put all our bags on the truck. They ran us down the street to the green fence that, regiment was in. And we got in there, and they shut the gates. They started, all right, everybody raise your hand. Put your hand down when I call your name out. And so they start calling names out, and they kept calling names out, and I'm like, yeah, this is not going to go the way I wanted it to. I'm like, I'm fucked, rightly. I'm like, shit's going south right now. And they got all the way through, and I'm thinking, I literally have not even finished training yet. Haven't signed into my first unit yet. and they're going to court-martial me. They're going to put me in prison. Like, they're going to kick me out of the Army. I'm AWOL right now. I missed movement. I'm AWOL. Everything is wrong with this pitcher right now.
And you've got your hand in the air with a guy with a clipboard going, who are you?
Pretty much. And they're like, all right, Ranger, come up here. I'm like, well, cat's out of the bag now. I ran up there. He goes, last name, first name, middle initial, social, rank. All right, get back in line.
They just wrote you on the list.
It's an all-volunteer unit. Oh, and as far as they're concerned, I volunteered for it. They cut me orders for RIP. And 3 weeks later, I graduated RIP and went to Alpha Company 375. So, yep.
So how did they untangle the mess from where you were supposed to be?
So, regiment took precedence over the rest of the Army units.
Gotcha.
And it's a volunteer unit. And who's going to miss a PFC in all of the 82nd at that point?
So basically, they pulled rank.
For lack of better terms, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, they're like, hey, this kid volunteered to here, and they just, I'm sure they put in a 4187 or called branch, you know, infantry branch, and be like, hey, this serial number kid is now here right now. Now, had I not made it through RIP, they probably would have sent me to Korea or, you know, some podunk place needs the Army. Whoever needed a PFC 11 Charlie, I mean, I could have been, you know, the world could have been completely different.
Okay, so kids out there listening, so the lesson is still, if you're not bright, you better be tough.
Fortune favors the bold. So, yeah, and it worked out, you know. It was and it's a pretty cool story. I've told it a few times, whatever, and everybody's like, dude, that's a lot of balls. I'm like, yeah, well, it's a lot of stupidity too, so you measure it out yourself how you want to see
really
it.
You really didn't want to go 82nd, evidently.
No, I really didn't. My brother was in a Ranger regiment, and I'd read all the books, and, you know, the lure was there. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be an airborne Ranger, and that was my shot to take, and if it didn't happen, it didn't happen, but it worked out for me. So,
well, and I think, yeah, outcome defines whether it's stupid or brave.
Sure.
Yeah. So, it's true. It's a fine line there.
But I was, I started out as 11 Charlie, and then my first 19 months, whatever, and I went to Ranger School. And when I came back, when you graduate Ranger School, it doesn't matter what your MOS is, you get a secondary MOS of 11 Bravo because they consider it, like on job training or whatever.
Right.
So at that point, it was a very simple 4187 paperwork trail that just changed my secondary MOS to my primary MOS. And because they were both infantry, it was a lateral move anyway. And I moved from being in headquarters company at that time, because they consolidated all the mortars out of the line unit and put us in headquarters company, and then gave us all three gun systems. So we had a 60s while we were in a line unit, and then when we got to headquarters, they gave us the 81s and the 120s in addition to. So we did a lot of training up on those. When I was still in Alpha Company, we were really short on 13 Foxes in the 5th section. And so for about 4 months, 4 or 5, maybe 6 months, whatever, I went over and trained as a 13 Fox as a Fister in the 5th section. And then after Ranger School, I went and changed over to 11 Bravo, went to the Sniper section, stayed in the Sniper section for a year. And then went to a line unit, did my team leader time, and then got promoted and went to Charlie Company 375 as a squad leader. And then I got promoted to E6 on August the 1st of 2001. And then we all know what happened the next month. So within 2.5 months of me being promoted to squad leader, I jumped into Afghanistan with my own fire, my Ranger squad. So
was that your first deployment, was Afghanistan?
Yep. Yep. My first two deployments were Afghanistan. So we jumped into Afghanistan, cleared Objective Rhino. We spent some time in Pakistan during that deployment. Really slow. It started off, that whole theater operation started off really slow. And then, 2 years later or whatever, we got into the Iraq thing or whatever. And that picked up. The tempo was higher in Iraq than it was in Afghanistan initially. But about that time, after my first two deployments, whatever, with a misunderstanding with some of my chain of command, it was better for me to leave the regiment.
Oh, so there's a story there I haven't heard yet.
No, it was a personality conflict that started when I was a corporal, and this dude was an E7, and he had a big group of friends, and it actually cost me, like, for the next 17 years of my Army career, I dealt with some bullshit from these guys, because it's a small community. Once you get into that small of a community, and even the Ranger community that moves back and forth, you always bump into each other. And it was just, like I said, it was 17 years of a bunch of bullshit, and it was all because of pride and ego. So, and I'm not saying I didn't have my part of pride and ego, because I was a damn good young Ranger, and I made sure everybody knew it. So that didn't always work out for me.
Well, that's fabulous. I'm going to dig more stories out of this later, I can guarantee you.
This allows these kind of things to happen, then I don't want to be here anyway. And it was a brash decision that I will always regret having. But however, that move set me up for the rest of my life, you know, and so everything happens for a reason. So kind of funny, I go over to my first day that I go over to Kelly Hill. They show me what building it was. It's the headquarters of 269 Armored. It was an armored unit, and they had taken two of the tank platoons out of the armored unit and taken two of the infantry companies out of an infantry unit. They put them together. So you had two tank companies. You had a headquarters company. You had two tank companies, two infantry companies, and you had a maintenance support company. And so they called them combined arms battalions at the time, unit of actions. That way they can move. You can do a lot of things with one unit as opposed to having to take in several over or whatever, kind of the thought behind it. So anyway, I walk into the building, and there's absolutely no one in the building. I'm looking all over. I've never been in this building before. There's two floors. I'm looking all over the place. It's a ghost town. And finally, I walk out on the second floor on the back deck, and there's this dude, and he's kind of hanging over the rail or whatever. Kind of slouchy BDUs, kind of a thicker dude or whatever, and I'm like, you know, he's facing away from me, so I walk out, and I'm like, hey, do you know where anybody's at around here? And the guy stands up and turns around, it's the captain. And I'm thinking, like, shit, this is our company commander. So I, you know, snap to attention or whatever, and I'm standing there, it's like, sir, I'm, you know, reporting in, I'm, you know, Staff Sergeant Gilliland, I'm going to be the new Sniper Section Sergeant. And this dude's smoking a cigarette. He takes a big, long draw, and he's kind of looking at me, like, completely puzzled. Like, his face is like, who the fuck is this dude, right? And I'm, like, I'm in my Sunday best. You know, my BDUs are starched. My boots are polished. I mean, it's like I just walked out of, you know, my best day at regiment or whatever, because I'm a professional soldier. And this guy takes a big, long draw or whatever and looks at me and goes, are you standing at attention?
Oh, boy.
And I'm like, yes, sir, you're an officer, and that's what enlisted people do, to talk to officers. He, like, takes another big, long draw and flicks a cigarette out in the yard and says, I hadn't seen that in a while. I'm like, wow.
Welcome home.
Yeah. So, anyway, it was a weird first. Thankfully, that was the anomaly of the unit. There's actually a lot of very, very good professional soldiers there. The first sergeant we had, Richard Capps, was the first sergeant of the unit. Such an amazing guy. And I think he knew right away that I needed some adult mentorship. And I got a lot from that guy that I will always appreciate. But I got to select my guys. So we did a sniper selection. We put it out through all of the infantry units that were in that we were able to touch. Ran a big sniper selection course or whatever and picked, nine more guys. It was me, and then there was eight more dudes. There was a nine-man sniper section. There was a three-man teams. There was nine, and I was 10. Started training up because we knew we were getting deployed. You know, OIF, at the time, it would have been OIF-3. They'd already done the invasion, and it was coming up to their next rotation back overseas, and we knew we were going to hit that. So we started training up for OIF-3. And, man, I built a picked the right personalities, built a really good team, and felt really good about going overseas. So, and we had a pretty damn good, successful year.
So I know where you're going with this. And before we get there, let me pay a couple of bills real quick.
Fair enough.
And we'll be right back.
Beans, bullets, Band-Aids, and booze. While everyone forgets about the last one, 10th Mountain has you covered. With a range of whiskey, vodka, and cordials, you're sure to find just the right spirit for your next adventure.
Just remember to flip up your nods before you take a sip. Now shipping orders to nearly every US state so you can get in on the awesomeness. Enter Deer Shooter at checkout for 15% off your order. 10th Mountain Whiskey and Spirits Company. Whiskey worth fighting for.
Are you fed up with paying premium prices for mediocre performance? It might be time to up your game with Lucid Optics. Lucid Optics delivers world record-setting performance without breaking the bank. From long-range precision, hunting application, and the first-ever reflex optic in blue, your mission won't be compromised. Lucid Optics are built tough as nails for the most demanding situations, using ED shot glass to ensure your view is crystal clear and backing it up with a lifetime warranty. To learn more, ask your dealer or go to lucidoptics.com. Lucid Optics. On target. Under budget.
When it comes to your personal security, you want the best, and your training shouldn't be an exception. WyoTac is your one stop for all of your education and training needs, covering competitive, defensive, and hunting classes, as well as medical, fieldcraft, and survival courses. With over a decade of experience and with a network of resources, WyoTac can help to meet your goals. When no one is coming, you have to rely on yourself. Make sure you know what to do when the time comes. WyoTac. Empowerment through self-reliance.
So you get deployed.
Yep.
And that's, I mean, I don't want to hear the "I tripped up the stairs, dropped my rifle, and shot a dude" story.
Right, because that was the best one.
I don't expect you to tell the story either.
Sure. So we'll go through. So this whole year in a year deployment, because when I was in Ranger Regiment, we did short deployments. So all the special operations guys, they would do basically short tours, 3 to 4 month rotations over there. So very, very, very active while you're there, and then you get, you know, a little bit shorter time, you come back and you rotate out. So the big army did 1 year because they're much, much bigger units. So there's a lot of logistics to go into that. And so you're going for a year. Some guys spent 18 months or more overseas, but I was fortunate that my two big army deployments were 1 year deployments. So like I said, we showed up the unit, we did our train up, our selection, we did our train up, and then we get overseas. And our first duty station over there is in Bakuba. So our first 6 months was spent in not a super high threat area. What is a whole lot of shooting going on back and forth. A lot of stuff was going on. So a lot of insurgent training, a lot of classes, a lot of caches, a lot of movements through our area. But there was not a lot of bad guy shooting going on in Bakuba. But what that allowed us to do is it allowed us to do a real world train up, basically. So we perfected most of our craft under a lower threat environment. And then halfway through our deployment, we went to Ramadi. We got moved over to Ramadi. We took over for another unit was there. And that was a whole different world. So we went from, you know, Orange Grove farmlands, you know, spread out rural area to, 250 to 300,000 plus, up to 400,000. I don't remember now what Ramadi was, but somewhere 300,000, give or take 50, hub right on the Syrian border that was very, very well known for, you know, all of the illicit activities from the bad guys. I mean, it was a very, very...
they didn't like you there.
They didn't. It was obvious. So you drive around. So it wouldn't be Humvees or moving around or walking around in Bakuba. You know, families would wave at you or you at least smile at you or whatever else. And it was, like I said, it was a lower threat environment. It was not a no threat, but it was a low threat environment. We got rocketed and bombed and shot at and whatever else, but it wasn't a daily occurrence. When we drove into Ramadi, there was only hate and discord. That's all you could feel. It was palatable. Like, you could feel it coming in. There were, on Route Michigan, going through the center part of Ramadi, we had 100-plus IEDs a week when we first showed up. And it was, you know, constantly getting shot at and a lot of those things. Anyway, long story short, we started doing our thing. We started hunting in Ramadi or whatever, and got very successful really quick. Things were just laying right out in front of us. It was not a, you know, anytime you're hunting, doesn't matter what you're hunting, it's pretty simple. If you know where your prey sleeps, where your prey eats, and where they drink, you got to get between one of those three places, and you'll see them. So we started paying a lot of attention. We spent a lot of time, you know, watching through glass and just seeing how the environment moved. And we got a lot of engagements. And it was, you know, it was not a single target here, single target there. I mean, there were multiple target engagements we got in very early on. And within 3 weeks of us being there, there was a huge lull. It was quite obvious that they're like, what just happened? And it kind of the same thing with us, too. It's like, hey, we're used to shooting at people, and there's nobody out there right now. So kind of worked both ways, I guess. But within probably a month and a half of us being there, we went from 100 IEDs a week down to probably 20 or 30. And then within the 2.5 month mark, for the rest of the time we were there, we probably had maybe 10 IEDs a month. And I'm not saying that that was just us. I'm not going to sit here and be like, you know, I changed the face of Ramadi or whatever. I mean, that would be, you know, that's bullshit because it takes everybody or whatever. But
there was a definite, with your guys' exposure, there was a definite increase in pushback.
There was, yes. It was quite obvious that somebody's paying attention, right, and very lethal. We had the asymmetric warfare sent a couple of guys down, interviewed us. They went out with us a couple of times. Like, what are you doing? Because your numbers are way different than everybody else in the whole theater right now. Like, what you're seeing, what you're doing, and what's happening in this 2,000 meter by 2,000 meter square is an anomaly, and we want to know why. And so we took them out. We showed them. It was like, look, you know, we were in several different, you know, S2 briefings, intelligence briefings, whatever. And, you know, intel that would be coming down to us that they were putting out, I'd be like, that's not right. You know, that might be somewhere else, but that's not what's happening in our area. And here's where we're doing. Here's where the bad guys are living. This is where they're eating. This is where they're drinking. This is where they're associating. I could tell you, you know, within 2 or 3 days of when a big meeting's coming up, and I can tell you about where it's going to be because we have watched the aura of life at this point, and we know when and how things are changing. And it's not because we're awesome. It's because we're paying attention, because we're the only people in this entire unit that spend 3 or 4 days in a building in the middle of town with no help looking at life. We're just watching people. And we're taking targets for opportunity while we're doing it, but we're spending, you know, days on end watching the movement of what's going on. And people are people, you know, no matter where you come from, no matter what your intentions are, you know, we're humans. And
creatures of habit.
Yeah, we're creatures of habit, and everybody's that way. So, but it was a unique time and place. You know, it was just right time, right place. Anybody could have come in and probably done what we did there in Ramadi, but we just happened to be the people that were there at the moment. So
I'm going to bring that back to the evolution of the conversation we were started on. You went and did all of this.
Sure.
Then you retired.
Sure.
Right? And the volume on life gets turned down kind of exponentially.
Exponentially.
And you got really good at doing nothing.
Sure.
And now you're having
got really good at getting fat.
Yeah, we have a friend in common that made a remark that you hopped out of a truck one day and was like, "Geez, did you eat Jim Gilliland?"
Damn right.
So, how have you gone from the transition of being in and that guy to being out? And well, you're still that guy.
Sure. Well, so yes and no. There's definitely, and look, if I could reach into any conversation that any specifically military guy has, or in general, anybody that's having a big life transition, for 20 years, I was lived under, actually for more than that, for my entire life, because I went basically from, you know, high school into the military. There was a little break there, but not much, but I had a time, place, and a uniform that I had to be in since I was 5 years old. So when I started kindergarten, you had a time to be somewhere. You kind of had to wear a certain kind of clothing. I mean, you course, that was a little different or whatever. I didn't wear a uniform to school, but you wore school clothes to school because that's what we did in the 80s and 90s. And so it's a super structured environment. You've got a time and a place to be, and you've got things you got to do while you're there. And then join the Army. And you had a time, place, and uniform, and it was very structured. And it was a very easy thing to fall into. And then when you get out of that, that structure is gone. Mm-hmm. You have to build that structure yourself. So either you get out and you get a job that has a structure built into it, or you do what I did and get out and basically work for yourself. So right after I retired, I went to work for US Optics, and I did that for about 8 months. And then I started doing my own stuff with Shadow 6. And, you know, like I said, I had to build my own structure into it. And I did very well for the first couple of years because I was really busy. I was always on the road. I was always doing something. And there was always a transition point where I was the next thing, the calendar's full. And then, you know, the COVID slowdown happened or whatever else, and everything pretty much came to a stop, which was a nice break. But, you know, that break took way too long. And, you know, the day that I realized that I'm in trouble, right? Like, you look around, it's like, I'm in danger. is I had gotten so used to waking up in the morning, getting a cup of coffee, and sitting on the couch, turning the TV on, watching the news. And Melissa and Cash, you know, would get ready, and they would go to work or school or whatever. And I would tinker around and do a few things or whatever. But specifically on this one day, and I know it wasn't the first day that this happened. I mean, I had gotten very sedentary because there just wasn't a whole lot to do. You get in the habit of watching TV or scrolling your phone or whatever, right? So they got ready. Hey, love you. See you later. Bye. And leave the house. And like 20 minutes later, they show back up. And I'm like, what are you guys doing home? And they're like, it's 4:30. And I still hadn't got off the couch.
You lost a full day.
Yeah. And that was, like I said, I know that wasn't the first day that happened, but that was the first day that it crushed me that I was like, how sedentary have you become to allow yourself to be this way? And it was, you know, and it took, and it was not overnight. It wasn't like the next day I'm like, I'm running 5 miles, you know, because I still ain't doing that shit. But, right. That ain't happening.
Yep.
But I started, you know, I would find myself, I'd sit on the couch, and I'd realize I would, like, catch myself. It's like, oh, you're on the couch. And I would stand up and make myself do something. And then eventually, you know, and I would find myself back on the couch 20, 30, 40 minutes, an hour later, whatever else. And I would realize I'm on the couch again, and I was like, get up. And so, and it took, and I'm still not over it. You know, I'm a recovering couchaholic. Right. So, but it was one of the things. And so 3 times a week, started getting up and with a couple other dudes that was in town and going to the gym. So, you know, we started 3 days a week going, and it kept me accountable because it wasn't, I was going to the gym. It's like, these dudes are going to make fun of me if I don't go to the gym.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And so I was accountable to them. And, you know, my whole life, I've always worked harder for somebody else than I have for myself. You know, if it was up to me, you know, I would do things to get the job done or whatever, but I would give you a much better product if I thought it was for somebody as opposed to being for me. Character flaw, whatever that is. But so anytime I felt like somebody was waiting on me or somebody was anticipating something from me, I've tried to build that into, because I know that's one of my ticks, right? So I've tried to build that into other things that I've done and promise myself out to somebody to where now I'm accountable to somebody else to make myself get up and do these things. So, you know, you don't have to be, look, hey, I'm 47, I'll be 48, you know, toward the end of August or whatever. I'm still young, but where I had gotten physically and mentally, I was 85 years old, and it was a big, like, red light that went off, and it's like, you've got to start doing something now, because my dad was not in great shape. I mean, my dad was a real, you know, heavy guy or whatever, and he had, you know, all kind of issues or whatever, and he didn't take care of himself, and he paid the price for it. I mean, he was 73 when he died, you know, and I saw what he put my mother through trying to take care of him, and that's not something that I want to do to my family. So you have to look around and learn from, you know, you can always find lessons from people. Now, don't get me wrong, my dad was an amazing man, amazing dad, taught me so much in life that, you know, I'll never use all of the things that he taught me, But the other things that he taught me from his misgivings were the things that I need to fix in me, because he didn't fix them in him. So you can learn from anything from anybody, and it may be what not to do, or it could be how to, you know, how to do other things.
So I'm listening to this, and I see a description of gradually losing purpose. At what point did you find you had an identity crisis? Because, I mean, you're not James Gillen the Ranger that's active anymore.
Sure.
And you got to figure out who you are now.
Sure. You know, and one of the things, you know, and you know, people's intents and things change or whatever else. And don't get me wrong. I love shooting. I love the firearms industry. And I love everything about it. But, you know, you can hit critical mass in those things, too. And so chasing that next class or chasing the next thing or whatever else doesn't appeal to me like it did. You know, I still enjoy doing it. One of the things that makes me the happiest is when you set somebody up, you know, you set somebody up at a class to do something and they accomplish something, and you see, it's like you see that dopamine hit in their brain, and it's 10 times that for mine. When mm-hmm. when somebody accomplishes something they didn't think they could accomplish is a big, big dopamine hit for me.
I can relate to that.
And so, and, I mean, that's awesome, you know. But, you know, my interests have shifted a little bit from, you know, like I said, chasing that next long gun class or chasing the next pistol carbine class or whatever else to, you know, what is next for me? And that part I hadn't figured out yet. You know, I've gotten into working with the trucks or whatever else, but I'm still dealing with my couch demons or whatever. That's so hard to get
guy,
into.
This guy, while he talks about ADHD, he'll call. One day he's got a fork in a jar of kimchi. He's got Kydex cooking in the kitchen oven, which he knows he shouldn't be doing. He's got a bench with a gun torn down and a reloading project started. And he's got 9 million things going on at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
And he goes,
I don't know anything about that.
I need to talk to somebody right now that can focus me up. And I was like, all right, what's going on? Like,
thank God you called. I need somebody to pull me into a point. I'm looking around, and you know, I've got, you know, like I said, I got Kydex in the oven or whatever. I've got an open jar of kimchi, literally an open jar of kimchi sitting on the table. I've got a glass of tea poured, an open beer. I've got, you know, I'm brewing a cup of coffee. I've got a half-built knife project. I've got a gun taken apart, and I'm all over the place. And I'm like, I just need a focal point right now. And so, and that's one of the things that I've really, really, really kind of try to battle into as well, because it happens all the time. I get all these half-done projects or whatever, and then they become so overwhelming for me that I'm like, well, I don't even know where to start. Like, I got so much to do, there's not a starting point anymore.
Now, have you stopped doing competition?
I've not shot a match in over 2 years. And part of that, I got burnt out. Melissa and I were shooting 15 to 18 matches a year. We were traveling.
But you're running some now.
Yeah. So I've started match directing, over the last, you know, couple of, 2-3 years or whatever. And I've really enjoyed that. I've really enjoyed putting, you know, and they've gotten better. My first match, of course, like anything else, whatever. I mean, it was an okay match, whatever else. But the more that guys shoot them, and the, you know, I can see what they gravitate to and what they like more. You know, it's helped me, you know, build my structure, how I put the matches together. And I try to bring in some of the type of field shooting we did when I started back in 2011, 2012, you know, pull that back into the mainstream PRS world. Because, you know, when you talk to all these guys, it gets very monotonous. If you've shot 5 PRS matches across the United States, you've shot every match in the United States. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter where you go. They're all the same.
There's only so much you can do with them.
Sure. Well, there's only so much you can do on a flat range. Because once a place is built, so you have a range structure that you build, and you put props there and you put targets out, there's only so much you can do with that. And one of the things, so at Alta Shooting Solutions, where I've been running my matches, I've tried to look outside of the shooting point and the targets. So, you know, I'm on the rocks, and I've got the A1 lane that we always shoot the same targets from the rocks. Well, we've got all these targets to the right that span the whole range. So why don't we, I could shoot from the rocks, and I've got a 270 shooting area or a 180 shooting, you know, area. why don't we, I'm going to shoot that target in the far right-hand corner of this and start working back this way. And then on the A lane, I can go to the next one and shoot the A lane on. And so, you know, I've tried to shoot targets from different positions that we've never shot before. And that's been one of my, you know, one of my biggest things that I've tried to bring into, especially that range, is you know when you go to a range about what you're going to get into. You know how the, you know, especially if you've shot it as many places as much as, you know, Melissa and I have, you know, you walk up and the guy gives you a stage brief and you've already heard it 15 times, right? I know what bags I'm going to take to this stage. I know, you know, the only thing I got to pay attention to now is what's the mirage doing, what's the wind doing, you know, what's the climate or whatever, you know, what makes this one unique compared to the last one in the ballistics part as opposed to the structural part, because I know what I'm going to do. And so I've tried to break that up a little bit, and I think it's worked pretty well down there.
And as a match director, you've learned the hard lesson of stay off the motorcycle?
Yeah. Not really. So that was the dumbest thing ever, by the way. So so that story comes from 2 years ago. I was setting up for the Accuracy International match. And so I go down there a week early, and I'm putting all these targets up, and I'm getting everything laid out. And it comes a Thursday. I wake up Thursday morning, and, like, everything's done. Like, the matchbook's done, all the targets are out. The only thing I got to do is paint everything and range one target. Because I kind of had this little loophole area where you're looking through the bend of a tree, and that's where your target was. And it was kind of neat, because when you shot, your trajectory actually went over the tree, but you hit the target that was in the loophole, right? So that was kind of neat. But because of that, I couldn't get a good range, you know, I couldn't get a good laze on the target. So I've got this Cash, you know, our youngest or whatever. We bought him a little Honda 150 four-stroke motorcycle, dirt bike or whatever. And I've got it down there so I can run back and forth. Now, mind you, the whole week I've been driving this thing like an asshole. I'm jumping the berms. I mean, like literally doing dumb shit. Like should have died 100 times already. So this Thursday, and it's about 11 o'clock or whatever, and me and two other guys were down there, John Deal and Matt Shawless or whatever, and I'm like, all right, I'm just going to run down to the target and range this car, because we're shooting from a car, and it'll be a big thing, I can range that, whatever, no big deal. And so I tucked my t-shirt in, I'm t-shirt, flip-flops, pair of shorts. So I tucked my shirt in, put my rangefinders down my shirt or whatever, so that, you know, I don't have to hold on to them. And I jump on a motorcycle, and I'm just putting out there. Like, literally, I'm in third gear in a four-stroke Honda 150. So it's not like we're going 1,000 miles an hour, right? But I've got, you know, going back to my ADD or whatever, you know, I've got everything in the world going on in my head. You know, I've got to paint. I've got to put the targets in. I've got to make sure the, you know, all of these things are going on. And I just happened to glance down, and like 10 feet in front of me, there's this 18-inch wide 18 inch deep square ditch, and I literally just enough time to be like, it's gonna hurt. So that's exactly, you know, that's what goes through my head, is I look down and there's no time to stop, and I know it's a 154 stroke, there's no torque in this thing, so it's not like I can, you know, get in the throttle and get the front tire over it. It's we're getting hurt, right? So in this last second, I pull my toes back, and I put my toes right on the edge of the pegs or whatever. And so as soon as I feel the handlebars go down, you know, I push off on the pegs so I don't want this motorcycle to land on me. Cause I know it's going in the ditch and bouncing out of it. So, and here I am in my best Ricky Bobby. And I'm like, yep, I'm in the air. It's not good. So I'm flying through the air or whatever. And like out of nowhere, I scream inside my head, you know, cause nobody else is hearing this. Cause I asked, you know, the other two guys later or whatever. And they said, no, the only thing we heard is motorcycle rev up. But I'm screaming to myself, tuck and roll, you know, before I hit the ground. So, I ball up. I put my left arm up because I'm about to hit the ground or whatever. I ball my left arm up or whatever. And I hit. I had to be like 400 feet in the air. There's no way I could be any closer to the ground than that. Hit so hard, and I roll two or three times, whatever, and I end up on all, like, on my knees, on my hands, like, on my all fours or whatever, and I look up, like, straight out or whatever, to the wood line, and everything's like super, super bright. Like the sun's shining in my eyes, and I start seeing the edges getting dark. And it starts coming in. I'm like, oh, God, don't pass out. Starts to breathe. I was trying to breathe so I don't pass out because I know I'm hurt. You know, I don't know how bad I'm hurt, but at least I got the wind knocked out of me. And so by that time, these other dudes show up or whatever, and I everything starts coming back into color or whatever else. And so they help me stand up, and I'm hurt. Like, I'm very uncomfortable at the moment. So stand there for a few minutes or whatever else, having a hard time breathing, but I'm thinking, well, I just got the wind knocked out of me. It takes a minute, right? And so I stand there for, I mean, it's probably 2 or 3 minutes, probably not that long, but it's, you know, a minute or two or whatever. And so finally, I'm going to run back up to we're done. Here's the range, you know, because we ranged the target at that point or whatever. And so I jump back on the motorcycle and I ran, you know, I went back up to the lodge building or whatever. I was like, I'm going to go sit down for a minute and find out see how bad I'm hurt. And so I go up there, whatever, ride the motorcycle back up there and I sit down. They come in a little bit later or whatever. And as I sit there, it just gets worse and worse and worse and worse. And finally, I'm like, okay, I need to get up and move. Like, if I sit here, it's obviously getting worse. You know, I need to move around a little bit and try to loosen up. So I tried to lean up and get up, and that wasn't happening. So I scooted off the edge of the couch, turned around, stood up, and I'm looking around. I was like, I can't see. And, of course, these two dudes are like, what? I'm like, I can't see. And they're like, oh, my God, we got to take you to the hospital. I was like, no, I lost my glasses, asshole. I can't see. My glasses are somewhere down there. So anyway, long story short, and I'll make this part real quick. So we had to go to town anyway, so we stopped by a little emergency clinic, not the emergency room. They did x-rays. Like, yeah, you got a broke rib. I was like, okay, fair enough. That hurts. I know, you know, I've bruised ribs before, but I never broke one. That's going to hurt. Nothing you can do about it, whatever. So I come back Thursday afternoon, and that night was terrible. And then Friday afternoon, I didn't tell Melissa what's going on, right? Because there's...
She would have killed you.
More to that. So she shows up about 5 or 6 o'clock in the afternoon on Friday afternoon. She comes up to give me this big hug, and I'm like, oh, no, I'm hurt. And she goes, oh, did you throw your back out? And I'm like, no, I broke a rib. And she's like, oh, you know, and I tell her the story or whatever. She said, why? You know, now she's mad because I didn't tell her I was hurt. I'm like, well, what are you going to do about it? I mean, you had to work and do whatever else. You're not going to run down here. So I ran the match. Everybody showed up on a Friday to shoot all day long. I ran the match Saturday, ran the match Sunday, cleaned all that stuff up. And then Melissa's like, you're going, because now I'm muscle spasming where I've tried to keep everything, you know, tightened up on my left side. And I'm really, you know, I tell everybody, oh, I had a motorcycle wreck, whatever, it's not no big deal, whatever. But everybody's like, yeah, I don't know, you might need to get checked out. So anyway, Melissa's like, you're going to the emergency room. I'm like, that's fine, but I'm going to do that in Columbus, Georgia. I'm not going to do that in Baker, Florida. I'm not going to be 4 hours from home and, you know, they tell me that I need to stay in hospital for a week. So I drove my truck home. Melissa followed me in her truck, whatever, got to the Columbus, went to the emergency room. And told them what happened. They put me in. They did the x-rays. Then, like, 10 minutes later, this little PA, little short lady, hilarious. This chick, she missed her calling as a comedian. So he goes, okay, so we're going to give you a few things for pain. And I'm like, actually, I feel okay right now. Like, now that I'm, like, sitting down, I'm not running all over the place. She's like, yeah, okay, we're going to give you a little something for pain. And then she ordered a CAT scan. So she came in and gave me some, you know, a T-bomb, Tramadol and some morphine or whatever, which that shit's pretty awesome. T-bombs is the shit anyway, but you mix the two and it's pretty awesome. So they get me into the CT room or whatever, and they're being like super, super tender with me. And I'm like, what's going on? And this little gal in the CT room's like, so what'd you think about your x-rays? I'm like, oh, I don't know. I didn't see them. She's like, oh. I'm like, oh, were they that good? And she's, of course, they can't say anything because of HIPAA or whatever. Yep. So... anyway, got a CT done and did it with contrast. I come back, and like 10 minutes later, there's nobody in the emergency room. We're like some of the only people, so it happened really fast. So I'm back in the room like 10 minutes later, and this gal, the PA, comes back in with a little clipboard, and she's like tosses it up on this little counter and leans up against it, puts her elbow on it, and she's like, all right, we've done good. I'm like, okay. She's like, well, we've broke ribs 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9.
Jim, that's the whole side.
pretty much. And I'm like, yeah, okay. Of course, I peek over at Melissa, and she's gone from empathetic to, you could tell she is pissed because I have gone the whole weekend with all these broke ribs or whatever. And she goes, and you've bruised all of your intestines and your spleen and like all this stuff right there on that side, all of that stuff bruised up. And I kind of look over at Melissa, and she's a little softer because she, you know, there's more going on. She's like, and you collapsed your left lung. And I'm like, oh. And then I cut over Melissa, and her empathy's back now, because now I'm fucked up, right? And it's obviously I'm fucked up.
You know that ache you felt on that side?
Yeah.
That's the lung.
Yeah. So she goes, so normally anything three ribs or more, you know, is a serious thoracic trauma, and we keep you in ICU for at least 4 days to make sure that you don't die. Like, so that like your lungs don't fill up with fluid or something cuts loose or you get a blood clot or you die. But since you've been out for 4 days now, running amok, we're just going to send you home for some pain medicine. That's when Melissa could have killed me.
There is the tough nature thing coming back out to bite him in the ass again.
Yeah, it is. So, but I mean, so when I was down there, in my defense, the guy said, yeah, you have a broken rib. And it's right, you know, it's right here. If it starts hurting really bad, then you may have ruptured your spleen. You need to get in the emergency room immediately. But it's going to hurt. I'm like, okay. So I think I'm just running around on okay. A broke rib.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was six.
So, well, Jim never does anything half-assed.
Obviously. Including fucking himself up. So I guess what... we're like way the hell over time. So... To wind this down, what do you blame for that? The ADHD or the motorcycle?
Yes.
Pride.
Pride.
You blame pride.
Okay.
No, that was just dumb luck. So, but to wrap it all up, if I had an amazing military career. I learned so much. I got to do so many cool things, so many cool classes. It was a wonderful, wonderful 20 years. I was told the same advice, you know, when you get out of the Army, don't stop, you know, keep going, you know, you're not chasing 20-year-olds anymore, but keep moving, keep doing things, be active, because, you know, an object in motion stays in motion, and if you can't put it any simpler than that to any of you guys that are out there, stay in motion, and if you find yourself being sedimentary, like I did, it takes one decision, you know, you make one decision to get off the couch to do something. And then when you find yourself in the same position, you make that decision and then set little goals and start doing stuff. And I'm not out of this funk yet or whatever else, but I am infinitely better than I was, you know, 8 months ago. So.
Good advice.
Great advice.
And get out there. And if you're, where are you doing your matches at? Alta?
Alta Shooting Solution. Yep. Baker, Florida.
There you go. So if you get a chance, go to a Jim Gilliland match, because I'll guarantee it'll be an experience.
It's fun. Oh, they're a lot of fun. If you don't have fun at one of my matches, then you shouldn't have come to it. You know, I'd rather you have as much fun as you did having shooting.
All right. So on that note, you know what? You guys just keep blaming the gun.
That's right.